This is What's It Like with Dr. Ken Tangen.
Tangen, this is episode 90 of What's It Like. My guest is Joe Politz. Politzi. What kind of derivation is that?
That's Sicilian.
Sicilian, oh.
Yeah. Yeah, the best part of Italians, I believe.
Well, one of the more infamous anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they know how to get their way when they want it, I guess, right?
I'm assuming you didn't grow up in Italy.
No, I did not, no. My grandparents did. They made their way over from Sicily, came over in the early 1900s, and landed in the Cleveland, the Sandusky, Ohio area, and I live in Cleveland right now.
Oh, so you grew up in Cleveland?
I grew up in Sandusky, and if you know, anybody who knows Sandusky knows Cedar Point, which has been rated for years as the number one amusement park in North America, or the movie Tommy Boy, which was Chris Farley, and that actually took place in Sandusky, Ohio. So those are the two. It's about an hour west of Cleveland, but I actually live in Cleveland now.
I see. So you made the big move.
Made the big move, yeah, absolutely. It was the long move over to Cleveland.
Did you come from a large family?
I have an older brother and an older sister, so not really. But I came from a musical family.
Oh.
So my mother plays piano and sings, and my older sister is a music teacher, and my brother is a music performer. He actually played on American Idol in the band for a year. And he's out in Los Angeles trying to make his way, and I'm the one that got no musical talent and had to figure out something else to do.
You attend the shows.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm a good audience member.
So when you were growing up, did you have a favorite possession?
A favorite possession? I don't think anybody's ever asked me that question. Like, what do you mean by possession? Like, just something I'll tell you, probably the best thing is I collected baseball memorabilia.
Oh,
so I'm big. I still am. I mean, I don't collect like I used to, but I still have a rather large collection of mostly Cleveland Indians baseball cards, signed bats, big into like today, like Jim Thome, who's still one of my favorite players, still going strong today. But Albert Bell, Carlos Baerga, and then historically, I love Bob Feller. So I have a lot of Bob Feller stuff, Larry Doby memorabilia. I still have all that kind of stuff. And of course, Wheaties boxes and things like that. It actually was kind of an addictive thing for a while where I used to, every baseball card show, sports show, I was there buying something. So
it's funny. The Dodgers are celebrating their 50th anniversary of being in Los Angeles. But when I was a kid, they were in Brooklyn, and so I still think of them as the Brooklyn Dodgers.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely.
Shame on them for moving. You know?
Exactly. Well, of course, yeah, and Jackie Robinson just celebrated his 65th year of breaking the color barrier, so that was it, yeah.
When you were growing up, who had the biggest influence on your life?
My parents were great. I always remember my dad. He always made time, no matter if times were tough or whatever. He was working at Ford Motor Company. He'd always find the time to get out and play catch with me. My mom was always there to pick me up from school, all that stuff. But I think that as an entrepreneur today, the biggest impact on me was my grandfather. My grandfather ran a number of funeral homes. Mm. So he was an embalmer, a funeral director. And every weekend I would spend the weekend with my grandma and my grandpa. Mm-hmm. And I got the opportunity to spend a lot of time at the funeral home, like a lot, like it was almost our second home, which is, it's kind of strange for a lot of people. But I mean, we were around a lot of visitations, wakes. I've been to a ton of funerals, obviously. And then when I became 16, I started working there. And worked 2 or 3 years at the funeral home. But I think my grandfather, what I loved about it, and they say that, you know, people that are entrepreneurs, the majority of them are around an entrepreneur or influenced by somebody else. That was my grandfather, who was very successful in the city of Sandusky, Ohio. I mean, everybody knows who Leo Groff is. And he, what I loved about what he did with his funeral home, it was a very personal business. Of course, being a funeral director, the whole business is personal, but he knew everyone's name in the entire city. And what I remember most, he would tell me these stories back in the Depression when people couldn't afford to actually get a proper burial. They would come to him with anything they had, like, you know, can you please do this? And they would give him rings and jewelry and whatever. And I remember the one day he showed me this big box of just jewelry and stuff that he never did anything with. He just took it because it was important for them to give him something and say, yes, I paid for my wife's or my father's or mother's burial with this ring or whatever piece of jewelry. And he said he took it not to do anything with it because he never did, but the fact that it was important to them to know that they actually paid for it, especially at a time when everyone was hurting so bad. And I just thought that was interesting that, you know, he did that. He lost a lot of money during those times doing those things, but he took it. And I think that was one of the reasons why he grew his business, because it was more about being a human being than being a business person. And I think that is the key to being a good business person, is being a human.
Mm-hmm. So. But he allowed them to have dignity in the process.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
What was your major challenge as a child?
Oh, geez. When I was growing up, I didn't get any, the grades were terrible. I never did any work, any homework at all. And there was probably one time I went to a Catholic school, and it was almost like, I can't remember what she did. I think she hit, one of the nuns hit me upside, Sister Mary Rose hit me upside the head and said, Joe, you're smarter than this. Why don't you just decide to get good grades? And I'm like, oh, I guess I could. I mean, I didn't think anything of it. And it was funny from that moment on, this was in the fourth grade. And then from fourth grade on to graduating from high school, I got one B after that. Because it's just, you know, it was nice. She just basically said, you make a choice. Make a choice to do that. It wasn't really a hardship or anything. I mean, I remember my parents, my dad went through a couple tough times of unemployment and owned a restaurant that went under, and it was tough, but I remember that they really worked hard and made sure that we never wanted for anything, even though I know that they were really struggling. I think as a professional now, the biggest thing that I struggled with is actually figuring out what my calling was. I graduated from Bowling Green State University, which is near Toledo, Ohio, then went on to Penn State University, got my master's in communication. And I can tell you that even when I graduated from Penn State, I still had no clue what I wanted to do with my life.
Well, that's not what college is for. College is to educate you, not give you a job.
Yeah, well, I think that what I was hoping that college would do, high school, college, anything, I was hoping that it would direct me in a place where I would see maybe what my passion would be or find that. And it just never did. And it was just dumb luck that I ended up finding it down the road. But that was probably the toughest thing, is to actually find what the heck am I going to do with my life and actually make the world a better place. It was a struggle for a long, long time. And it's what's most exciting about being where I am now, because I enjoy what I do. I think we're giving back a lot of different things, and it's fun actually finding something that you're good at and passionate at the same time. I don't think it comes around very often. I think of this, there's Chris Rock, the comedian, always talks about this thing where some people have jobs and some people have careers. And those people that have careers, don't be making fun of those people with jobs that are sad that have to go to work every day. And don't be making them feel bad about how wonderful you feel every day about having a career. That's kind of where I feel right now, where I finally found that career path. And then I see a lot of my friends who are just struggling, don't want to go to work every day, and, you know, don't want to get up in the morning. And with us, it's like there's just not enough time in the day to get all the good stuff done, which is, didn't have that in the past. It's just nice to have that today.
So what exactly do you do?
So right now, the easiest way to explain it is I own a media company. We own – sorry about that. We'll have to let that go to voicemail.
It must be a media company.
Yeah, somebody's calling. Hopefully they want to give us money and they're not calling for money is always the thing we like to talk about. So I started in an industry called custom publishing about a dozen years ago. That's kind of how I found my passion. Custom publishing, now content marketing, is the idea that brands themselves need to think and act like media companies. And we're seeing more and more companies do this, where instead of, let's say, traditionally where I would have bought a TV ad or I would have bought an advertisement in a newspaper or a magazine, now what I would do is I want to be the media. I want to create the interesting content. Instead of, let's say, sponsoring this, let's say you're doing this as a podcast, instead of being the company that sponsors the podcast, I want to create the podcast. I want to create the really good content. And social media has really exploded this whole thing about changing the marketing departments, you know, in small, medium, large size brands, where they're creating and distributing valuable content instead of being the interrupter, instead of saying, no, don't look at this content in Time Magazine. Look at this ad over here to the right. That's the difference. So more companies, companies like Procter & Gamble or American Express or small companies, B2B, B2C, doesn't matter. They're saying, wow, in order to get attention, in order to retain customers today, we've got to create the best content to make their lives better or their jobs better, more fulfilling in some way. And that's how we're going to get their attention and ultimately grow our business. That's called content marketing. And basically what happened in 2007, when I left my job at Penton Media, where I was selling custom publishing and executing that, started a company which is now called the Content Marketing Institute, where we educate and train people about how to do this thing, how to do content marketing, how to think and act like publishers, how to show return on investment for it, how to insource or outsource it, or if they're, how do you do the best of breed blog or a magazine or a webinar or whatever the channel is, or podcasts for that reason. So just kind of found myself personally in a lucky space because I was one of the few people, if anyone, was using this term content marketing. I thought the custom publishing dated it. People thought of books, and I started to spin the conversation around content marketing, created a blog, put a ton of content behind it, and 5 years later, we're probably the place where people go to online and in person events. We have a large event called Content Marketing World every year that people go to. And so from 2007, from starting a blog, just me personally, we've created a little mini media empire around content marketing, where we do multiple online posts and news stories per day. We have the largest event in the industry. We have a magazine called Chief Content Officer. And I go around and do probably about 100 either online or in-person events a year. And I speak all over the place. I've spoken 10 times in Europe. I speak on probably two webinars at least per week, and usually one in-person event per week.
Well, that's a big change in just a short period of time.
A little bit, yeah. And it's just, I mean, the whole reason, or probably one of the biggest reasons why the company is successful, is because I just went out there and just talked about it wherever we could. Mm-hmm. and just evangelized the whole idea that marketers, brands actually need to think differently. And social media has really helped, because we always talk about, hey, if you want to be successful in social media, you have to have something interesting to say. Well, that something interesting to say is content marketing. It could be all kinds of different channels or whatever, but we always say, hey, well, nobody's going to follow you on Twitter or fan you on Facebook or care anything about you as a company unless you give them the gift of content. Mm-hmm. So what is your gift?
As you were describing it, I was thinking of Coca-Cola and, you know, sort of inventing Santa Claus for us. It was certainly one of our iconic views of what Santa Claus looks like is from Coca-Cola.
That's right.
Giving you an image of a bottle. That's kind of the original content marketing, isn't it?
I think you could look at it that way. I mean, that's obviously that's more of we call that visual storytelling. I think it's funny, the equivalent of that today is how brands are going crazy over social networks like a Pinterest, where Pinterest is basically the social network for pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're I think absolutely that's true. What when people say, is content marketing new, a new thing? I always say, well, no, it's been going on. I always say that if it was, we could go back to the era of cave people and there'd be some caveman scrawling whatever they could on the side of the cave saying, here's six reasons why you need to use a spear. I mean, because they were trying, in order to sell the equipment, they're trying to educate people about it. Mm-hmm. So that's, I think that's the big deal. John Deere actually gets credit for starting this whole thing back in 1895, where they created a magazine called The Furrow Magazine, where it was targeting farmers and how farmers could use the technology of today. Now, John Deere wasn't pitching their products. They were educating, but at the same time, they were creating a loyal follower base. And people were saying, wow, I want to buy John Deere products and services, but not because John Deere was saying, buy this tractor. They were doing it because, well, John Deere, that's my go-to source. They are the leading expert in the industry. I'm going to buy from them. And, of course, now it's called content marketing today in 2012.
So if I have a widget to sell, then I need to provide my potential audience or my potential customers who I want to sell the widget to with more information about how they would use it, how to apply it, how to that kind of thing?
Yeah, exactly. So I'll give you a real-world example. So let's say that you are a heating and air conditioning contractor. So most people think, well, shoot, who wants to listen to an HVAC guy?
Well, another HVAC guy.
Well, if you're an HVAC guy, and so first of all, no consumers want to fan or follow their HVAC guy. So how do you use this type of tactic or strategy to help your business? And you'd say, well, I'm a homeowner, and so as the HVAC guy, you got to figure out what are your customers' pain points? What are keeping them up at night as it relates to your business? So you'd say, okay, well, as a homeowner, I'm concerned about energy efficiency. I'm concerned about saving money on my bills. I'm concerned about making sure my furnace doesn't blow up. I'm concerned about how many times I need to change my filters. And should I look at one of those new thermostats that look like an iPad? You and I could come up with questions all day long. What I'm going to tell that HVAC guy, I'm going to say, you answer all those questions. Every time you go out on a call, your customers have questions. I want you to write those down, and I want you to answer those questions online. And the more and more you can do that, the more people are going to find you via search. They're going to find you via their social networks. Wherever your customers are hanging out, you want to be the leading expert in that industry. But you have to provide the storytelling and tell those stories so that those customers can actually relate to, okay, well, oh, I get that. These are the five ways to do this. Oh, I get that. And then when they're ready to make a buying decision, they think of that HVAC guy because that's the one that's been providing that great information for them.
Mm-hmm.
And it works. It just takes time. It's not like I always say that it's an asset. It's asset marketing compared to if I'm going to buy an ad somewhere, that ad is shown and then it's gone. I don't get any money for that. Content marketing is like buying a house. It's like, I'm going to create that content, and that content is evergreen. That can work for me for years. People can find that piece of content on Google 10 years later if people are still going to, if it's still valuable. Or people can continually share that content on Twitter or Facebook or LinkedIn or whatnot. So that's what we're trying to help our customers with. And most people aren't used to thinking that way, but this is kind of the wave of the future, and it's kind of the meat of what social media really is.
Does it work for products that are not as tangible?
Like consulting?
Yeah.
Actually, it's more important for consulting companies, I think, than any other companies. Because let's say you use your Coca-Cola example. I can touch, I can feel, I can drink, I can taste Coca-Cola. So there's a reaction there to your point. If I am McKinsey or I am Forrester, I don't have a product. My product is not really knowledge, and it's my employees, and it's those types of things. So how do you communicate that expertise outside of traditional marketing? Well, you have to show your expertise through content, through the stories you tell. And our whole take is a lot of consultants don't want to give away all the secrets to their business because they feel that, one, their competitors will steal it, two, that their customers will take that information and do it themselves. Well, there's always that possibility. But our take is that most, you know, there's just because you have a recipe list doesn't make you a chef, right? That's what you have to think about. You have the opportunity, if you create the best of breed content in your industry, that the attention you will get because of that is going to outweigh any of the negatives of that. So I would say for professional services companies, it is imperative that they create the best content in their industry so that they can be seen as the experts, so people will hire them.
I would say that the other people stealing your content is probably more likely than people doing it on their own. We tend, yep, even if we have the instructions, not to do it.
I would probably agree with you, but it's funny, when you talk to a consulting company, they're more afraid of their cut of, like, let's say pricing information. Their customers taking that information, not doing the right things with it, or, you know, taking that and going to a competitor doing something on their own. And I tell them, I said, are you serious? I said, here's what I really say is, if a prospect actually did that, you wouldn't want them anyways. That's not the customer for you. Let them take your information and do something else with it. You focus on the 99% of the opportunities that are actual real opportunities.
And never overestimate the laziness of people.
That's a great point. Absolutely. Well, I think that if you look at a buying cycle for any product or service, and actually Google tells us this. Google just did a research study they call Zero Moment of Truth, ZMOT. It's a really good ebook. It talks about before somebody makes a buying decision, consumers make a buying decision for almost any type of product, they engage in 10 pieces of content. There's some stimulus. That stimulus, like, let's say I was going to buy a furnace. That stimulus could be my father-in-law coming over to me saying, Joe, you need a new furnace. Or it could be an ad I saw in a value pack or a magazine or newspaper or something like that. There's the stimulus. Before I make my buying decision, I engage on average in 10 pieces of content. My take is, if I'm the company that sells furnaces and I don't have my content in those 10 pieces of content to influence that buying cycle, I'm going to be left out of the purchase discussion. That's how critical online content is today.
It's probably even more critical if the buying cycle is short. I have students, for example, I teach statistics as well as psychology, and if I were to try to sell them something, they're only interested in that for that one semester. I mean, they're not interested in statistics on an ongoing basis, like, oh, let me join a blog about statistics. And nobody cares, you know. And so for people who have products that are short-lived or people who only buy them in a short period of time, having all that information must be even more critical for them.
Oh, I think so. I think what we're seeing a lot of that is when they need to make a buying decision that doesn't cost very much, a very consumer product, let's say an iTunes piece of music or something. They really rely on referrals, review content for that. They see that, they go ahead, they buy. There's not a lot of barrier to purchase that product, done. And that's where we talk about the more open you are on communicating content through social, the more reviews you can actually get. And so there's an opportunity there, but you have to seed the conversation in a lot of cases with content, and then people will share that content.
Point. Yeah, absolutely.
So, Joe, what's the best thing about your job?
Best thing is that I can spend time with my family on our own hours. We went and took a vacation last week, went to Florida, took the kids to Universal Studios, Legoland, Florida. Both, I highly recommend both of them, by the way. But technically, we're still working at the time.
Mm-hmm.
If I had a real regular job, I would have had to take vacation time to do that. There's another situation, 3 o'clock Friday, my son had baseball practice. Well, if I'm working my old job, I'm working till 5:30, 6 o'clock. And then I would have never made it to baseball practice. My job, I can do anytime. I can do anywhere. It's absolutely fantastic. And I love the fact that my kids are involved. I mean, they understand the business. They're right outside this door. So, you know, when I'm done, I can go out, say hi to them, ask them how school was. So I think it's just quality of life has taken it to the next level. And I never thought, if you asked me, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, if this type of a job was possible, I would have said, I don't think so. but the opportunity is so much greater than in a regular job, being an entrepreneur, as well as just the, you know, the family opportunities that you have to spend more time, quality time with your family. So I mean, that's why I think right now we are in a renaissance of entrepreneurship, because the job market has changed so much. I never say the job market is bad. I don't think the job market is bad. The job market has changed. The skill sets have changed and what's needed out there. I'll tell you, in my industry, there are so many open jobs right now to find really good content strategists, brand journalists, people that understand what we're talking about. But of course, there's not as many manufacturing jobs as there were. It's just the switch in that. The jobs are there. The skill sets are trying to catch up right now. So, but in the meantime, you got a lot of people that are just starting their own businesses because there's just not that right fit yet. So I think it's an exciting time to, because of the fact that you and I and everyone else, we could really start a business for almost nothing, be up and running, create the best content in the world on the web, and get found and grow a business, and you can compete with the big boys, and you don't have to have the capital that you used to have to do it.
Well, what's the worst thing about your job?
Sometimes the work never stops. Sometimes you almost have to train, and I still have problems with it. Train myself that sometimes you have to stop working, because literally you could work all the time. I'm at home. My office is here. I have an iPad. I have an iPhone. I have my computer. I'm always on, always accessible on Twitter and Facebook. Usually people know where I'm at. So sometimes it's just shutting it down. That's why we, as a family, we've instituted a no electronics Saturday, which has been very helpful because we've created some amazing Lego projects with the boys. I have two boys, and, just having that time, not on the iPhone or iTouch or iPad or whatever, talking to anyone else. I think that's been, it's been great for the family.
Mm-hmm. So. What type of person would be good at your job?
Well, I think you have to be extremely flexible, extremely outgoing, not afraid to fail at anything, or at least look at failure as a good thing. It's the fact that failure can open a door to something else. I try to keep that attitude. Sometimes it's hard to, but I try to keep that attitude. Yeah, we've actually, in some of the people that we've hired for Content Marketing Institute, they've come from a traditional work environment and they have not been successful because you don't have any supervisor. It's just you getting the job done. There's no water cooler activity is maybe online, maybe an email, but it's just you getting your stuff done and you have to have the drive to do everything on your own timetables. We don't have, like, our whole company, we don't have sick days. We don't have vacation days. We don't have a work schedule from 9 to 5. You just get the stuff done you need to get done. And if you need to take time off, take time off. Just let everybody know, which is great. Like, when somebody starts, they're like, well, can I get 2 weeks vacation? I said, you can have 5 weeks vacation. I don't care. Just make sure you get the job. They're like, they're floored by that. If you come from a traditional environment, you're like, are you kidding me? I'm like, yeah, I don't care. You get sick, you get sick. You need a vacation day, take a vacation day.
But you're not going to pay them.
Oh, I absolutely will pay them.
Really?
Oh, absolutely. We'll pay them for the job that they do. And if somebody gets the job done in one day of what people get it done in 3 days, then that's fine. You need to work. If you want to work 24 straight hours and not, three, I don't care.
But you're not paying them for vacation. You're paying them for the project completed.
They get it. Their monthly salary is their monthly salary regardless.
Oh, wow. So that's different from a lot of places.
I would say that we're one of the few companies that probably do that, but mm-hmm. I'm a firm believer in doing that and giving them ownership over how they get their job done.
Right.
And by the way, in 99% of the situations, I think we've seen incredible productivity because of that. Hmm. I'll be honest, there has been a couple situations that have not worked out, but for the most part, people love it. And what's great is that most of the people that we employ, they still pick their kids up from school. Some of them are stay-at-home moms. They have to be in a flexible environment, and that's what we can provide, and it's fun.
Are they distributed worldwide?
Oh yeah, we have we have some partners worldwide, but mostly just in the United States. So, like, I'll give you an example. So our chief, we're based in Cleveland. Our chief editor for the magazine is in Boston. Our content director is in Detroit. One of our editors is in San Antonio. Our consulting division leader is in Los Angeles. So we're spread all over. Our web development person's in Seattle. So we're all over the place, and it's, for the most part, it's worked just fine.
Mm-hmm. If one wanted to, how would they get a job like yours?
So I would say that you find what your passion is. So what that could be baseball cards, it could be trees, it could be the environment, it could be car axles. Whatever it is, right? And become the leading expert. And by the way, define that niche, like get really small. I always say, I give examples when I do presentations where a lot of companies, they'll make mistakes because they want to go too broad with their expertise level. So like I use pet supplies is a good example. Like if somebody wanted to start a blog for pet supplies, I always say, well, I think that Petco and PetSmart and those types of companies have sort of cornered the market on pet supplies. But what can you be the expert in? Maybe you're the expert in pet supplies targeting owners of dogs that like to travel with their dogs, like in RVs.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, there's a magazine called RVs and Dogs that they do. but that's the example, is that type of a niche. So find that niche that you're passionate about, and then create the best information on the planet around that niche. Once you do that, then the opportunities to create products around that give you, whether you actually want to sell pet supplies or whether you want to create a media opportunity or whatever you want to do, whatever, if you actually sell a real product or consulting, you need to first create the platform that positions you as the expert in the industry. There's no barriers to entry for this. It's just a heck of a lot of work to do it. And so I would just say, find your passion, figure out who your customer is, what your customer's pain points, and then solve those pain points every day, every minute of every day. And if you do that, take 6 months, a year, you will be successful.
What's a typical day like for you, if there is such a thing?
Yeah, there's not many typical days. This morning, got up, went for a run, which I do much better in this job when I run. Mm-hmm. I could just think about everything and get all that stuff out. And then got back. Kids went off to school, helped them get ready for school. And then after checked some email, took a shower, get ready for the day, had a couple conference calls in the morning, met somebody for a breakfast meeting, had a couple other conference calls. I'm about ready to write a blog post. I'll probably do another blog post tonight. And that's it when I'm here. A lot of it is calls. And then on the road, I do a lot of traveling. About 40% of the time is travel. I will, I'm usually speaking somewhere, doing some kind of a workshop, going out to having drinks with clients, whatever the case is, that kind of, what I like about it is that if I'm home, I'm two steps from the office and I'm right down the hall from my kids and my wife. And so the family environment's always there. And the second thing is every day is something different. I don't get up and say, oh, I know exactly what I'm doing every day. If I look at my calendar tomorrow, it's completely different than it was today. So all I know is I probably have some form of conference call or meeting or Skype call or podcast or something like that.
Joe, everybody has to give themselves motivation occasionally. How do you give yourself a kick in the pants?
Man, that's a good question, Ken. I would say, boy, it's very easy. So quick story, started the company in 2007. First 3 years, it was tough. It was tough to do what we're, it takes time to do what we're talking about, to actually become the expert in your industry. It takes a lot of content, a lot of speaking. And I had a business model behind it that wasn't working the way that it should. And I almost gave in to the failure. I almost like, oh, okay. I almost said, okay, we didn't do it. I got to go back and get a regular job. Last 2 years, it's all come together. It's been incredible to watch it. It's happen. So all that hard work came to that point. I think that there was a point a couple of years ago around that time where I almost want to see failure, like quick failure almost. I don't know if that is the right way to say it, but like if I want to try almost everything, and if we figure it out, fail quickly, and I'm not afraid of failure like I used to be in the past, because I was like, oh, what are we going to do? Well, what's funny about that failure back a couple years ago and now into today, if we wouldn't have had that failure happen, we would not be where we're at today. So that failure and what we learned from that has led into us being the successful company we're at today. So I would just like, if I'm not risking failure, then that really sort of motivates me every day. I'm like, are we actually risking enough? Are we taking enough chances? Because that's kind of our competitive advantage. We can move faster than anyone else. If you talk to another company that's even a company of 50 employees, they got to go through multiple levels of approval and get things done. Our staff is asked for forgiveness. I tell them everything. I'm like, you try whatever you need to try. And a lot of companies can't work that way. We can. So do what we need to do to get a competitive advantage and don't be afraid to fail. And I tell all our staff that. Some of them have a problem with that because they want to make sure they don't get fired. I'm like, you can't get fired for trying stuff. Like, do it, get it done, let's talk about it, let's learn from it, and we'll grow, and we'll create better products and services for our customers. So I just say, making sure I keep looking at failure every morning and see if I'm taking enough chances with the business.
Let me turn the question around. When you have to soothe yourself, how do you calm yourself down?
Shutting everything off, probably going down to the basement with the kids. That's where all the toys are. It's just getting into the Legos, sitting and talking to them. All these things, you know, any business problems, they're so insignificant compared to, you know, time with the kids and being there for them. And actually what's interesting, I mean, people that don't have kids don't realize this, but you don't have to be active with your kids when you're playing with them. You don't even have to play with them. You have to just be with them. Mm-hmm. It's be with them, listen to them. I mean, it's funny because my oldest son, Joshua, loves Lego bricks. And when he wants me to come downstairs, he doesn't really want me to play with him. He wants me to sit next to him so we can talk. And once you learn it, because I used to like, oh, come down. He doesn't want to play with me. I'd go back upstairs and do something else. Well, that's like, Joe, you didn't get it. So I would just say, you know, being with the family, and I just try to your question before, just to make sure that when I'm with the kids, I'm with the kids and I'm not distracted thinking about, oh, I got a call or I got to check this email or whatever. And I think that if you're not that way, especially as an entrepreneur, you can literally go nuts. And then you miss their childhood. I mean, they're already 8 and 10. They're already halfway to moving out. So, yeah. So I would say just spending time with the family.
Is there an event in your life that has challenged you to the core?
Boy, there's little ones all the time, but I think the one that I was talking about, where this was in 2009, and I remember vividly, I was in the backyard just walking back and forth, and I said, oh my gosh, we spent all this time and money, and I left a six-figure plus job, and this thing's going to be a failure. I can't believe it. And I like almost lost it. And it took a little while, took a couple days, but kind of made that turnaround. And I said, I can't believe, Joe, you're actually feeling sorry for yourself. Because I was like, oh no, woe is me. And I'm like, are you kidding me? This is not the attitude. This is not our attitude and how we've gotten this far. And, you know, it was just a couple months later, everything sort of turned around, but I thought we'd lost it. So, that's a big moment.
Is there an idea or principle that helps you through your challenges?
There's a statement on the back of a sugar packet. I kept it from when I was, I was probably like 8 years old, and I always kept it. I probably still have it somewhere, but I remember it. It said, if you have tried something and failed, you are vastly better off than if you have tried nothing and succeeded. So I think about that all the time. And I think that most people that I deal with, most of my friends, they don't try to think about risk in that way. I mean, it's almost like if you don't risk that, you're not having fun. I mean, that's where all the fun comes from. It's like if you're not doing that, you're missing out. And I would say that type of mentality, and realize that if you're not stretching yourself like that, if I'm not stretching myself like that, then I'm not going to become the human being I want to become.
If you were giving a commencement address for high school or college, giving your best advice, what would you say?
God, if you, I would. You're talking to a guy that's done six. I've done 6 years of college, and I might actually tell them not to go to college.
Mm-hmm. Because.
I would actually have to say this to my kids as well. I firmly believe, and you've mentioned this before, I believe that college is not for, I don't believe college is for necessarily for education. It's for maturity. It's for growing up. It's for understanding who you're going to be. It's for finding some friends. It's for reaching out socially, those types of things. I can't remember anything I learned in college. I learned a lot. I learned a lot to become a human being. Not that there's anything wrong with teaching, because I taught public speaking for 2 years myself. So
you're saying my life has been a waste?
No, I'm saying that I wasn't ready at that age for that kind of education. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't, right now, is the time when I think about actually going in and learning. Because I don't think that people, when they're that young, at least I'm talking about me personally, 18 to 22, I wasn't ready for that kind of education. I needed to mature. I didn't even, you probably understand this because you deal with kids that don't realize what a gift it is to be able to learn this type of stuff that we're learning. And I would say I think that people need, at that age, they should be risking some stuff. They could be doing what they need to do. They need to mature, and then they're ready maybe for college. I don't know if I would. I know I might have done some things different. I might have done a couple internships. I don't know. Who knows? I don't regret the education that I had, but I didn't appreciate it the way that I do now. Now, I literally learn every day something new in a different format. I go to conference sessions all the time, do that kind of stuff. It's almost like, how do you get that learning environment so that people are learning all the time and appreciate it that way? I mean, I don't know. You probably have a take on this because you're in it every day. I don't know. What do you think?
It's not my
comment. It is. You're the teacher. You tell me.
Well, college gives you several things that you wouldn't get otherwise. Well, one of the primary things you get out of college is self-management. You learn how to control your time, how to do this project and that project when they're both due the same day. You learn how to extract meaning from something. You read the book and you extract what you think is important, and you learn to learn it. You learn to memorize it, to study it, to understand it, and be able to apply it. And all those are education things, not
necessarily something you get in a class where you learn how to learn.
Yeah.
You learn how to cope. I agree. I buy with you. I buy that. Absolutely. I think it's interesting. It's tougher today when you see, especially in my industry, you see people coming right out of high school and they've got, you know, $500 million by the time they're 24.
Yes.
So it's tough. And you get the most successful people in the history of technology never finished school.
That's right. Yeah.
So it's just interesting to see that. But I would probably go back to the question as well and say, find that thing. Don't look for a job. I would say make your job.
Mm-hmm.
which is the biggest way. I think everybody is almost like, oh, okay, well, I'll go to 4 years or 6 years of school, and then I will fit myself into that job, which I don't think that exists as much as it used to. I think that right now you've got to say, okay, well, how can I make my own job so I'm not beholden to anyone else? And that's where I think the opportunities are greater than ever before. So that's where finding that passion, and everybody really can succeed and have a job in their passion area. But I don't know. I mean, I don't think a lot of high school kids are getting that. I think that they're still saying, oh, hey, what do I want to be? What I would want to do is say, what is your passion? And then let's figure out how we can monetize that down the road. That's what I would say.
I want to thank Joe Palazzi for joining me today. Thanks, Joe. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
If you'd like to leave a comment, ask a question, or get more info, go to whatsitlike.info.